Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, dinosaur expert and dinosaur consultant on Jurassic Park, Don Lessem talks to me about a life lived in service to T-Rexes and Brontosauruses. Jaws is 50 and we celebrate with Ireland's biggest fan, Ian O'Doherty. And as always, all the week's new movie releases to stream, skip or go and see in the cinema. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well. I want to start the show by mentioning the sad passing of a man called Philip Molloy, who regular and long-time listeners to News Talk will be aware of. He was a journalist, a newspaper editor, a newspaper man in the traditional sense of the phrase, and then he worked in News Talk for a long time. He was the resident film critic and presented the show that came before this one, I suppose, The Picture Show, which was News Talk's film show for many, many years that I produced with him for a good few years. You know, people say all the time, this person has an encyclopedic knowledge of whatever, music, movies, sport. And often that's over-egging it. But in Philip Molloy's case, I can definitively say he had an encyclopedic knowledge of cinema. And I've met lots of so-called film buffs. I even claim to be one from time to time, but I can say hand on heart, I never met anyone who knew as much about movies as Philip Molloy did, and who had such great stories about things that happened on movie sets, and great stories about his own time interviewing people, like when he got into a row with William Shatner because Shatner accused him of showing up late to an interview, which he hadn't, or interviewing a very famous movie star when he was very drunk, the movie star that is, in a hotel room with a club sandwich. He had great stories and he was a consummate film professional. And I just want to mention him at the start of this show and express my condolences to his family on the sad passing of the great Philip Molloy. Last week on the show, we had a music special. I was having a little holiday. I was in Euro Disney. Supposedly Disneyland, the happiest place on earth. Certainly the most expensive place on earth. Look, I'm not complaining, except I am. The kids had a great time. I had a great time too. The roller coasters are par excellence, but it's very, very expensive. And you have all these kids running around seemingly very happy and all these adults kind of look in their eye, how am I going to pay for all this? But we did have a great time. I have to say, I don't think I ever need to go to Paris again. There are certain sections of Paris that have become almost like unreal or hyper-real or like Las Vegas. When you go to the Eiffel Tower now, it's no longer a place in Paris. It occupies some other existence, if I'm not being too elusive. It is so overrun with tourists. And again, people trying to sell you stuff, that it's almost like you're not in Paris anymore. I'm not sure I'm quite describing this well. It's a bit like going to the Trevi Fountain nowadays. It seems to exist in this hyper-tourist space that's no longer anything to do with the actual country it's in. So if I never went to Paris again, I think I would be fine with that. It's just overrun with tourists, or certainly the places I was in it that my kids were dying to see, like the Eiffel Tower and like Champs-Élysées. But anyway, these are just wry musings on my travels that are probably of no consequence to you. The funniest thing that happened on our trip to France was, like a lot of people, I did French in secondary school and attempted to use it from time to time. Most notably on the bus to Euro Disney from where we were staying, when I said, "Je voudrais aller au Disneyland." And much to the amusement of my children, the bus driver said, "It's okay, I speak English." So there you go. Now in TV this week, I was watching this.
After the 1982 case, Johnson & Johnson very quickly changes its manufacturing process to add three different seals to Tylenol bottles.
The outer box has glued flaps that must be forcibly removed to reach the bottle. And it has a tight plastic neck seal, which covers the cap and the neck of the bottle. And finally, there is a strong inner foil seal over the mouth of the bottle.
when these seals are put in place. Both Johnson & Johnson and the Food and Drug Administration say, essentially, that this kind of poisoning can never happen again.
The pain reliever we use in this family is Tylenol, and we've been using it for a long time. So if anyone asks me if I still use Tylenol, my answer is yes.
Tylenol, you can trust our good name.
Yeah, now that is on Netflix, Cold Case, The Tylenol Murders. This is a three-parter, very engaging watch, I have to say. Plays you like a violin, obviously, keeps you watching, and at its source is a horrible story about seven deaths in the early 80s in a district in Chicago where Tylenol was laced with a poison and seven people died. And I don't want to give too much away, but trying to get to the bottom of how this happened is a fascinating tale and one that may not give you the answers you wanted. And the sense of, you know, this was a pre-internet age and there was people dying taking this over-the-counter medicine. And there was literally cops going up and down the streets with megaphones saying, do not take Tylenol. It's evoked very well in this, the panic. And then also, and the tragedy, of course, but then also who was responsible. And they interview police people, they interview suspects, they interview journalists at the time, one of whom you heard there. So I don't want to say too much about it because it is very twisty, but it is a gripping watch and something I barely knew about. I thought it was kind of an urban myth, but this actually happened and the telling of it is told very well. So that's The Tylenol Murders on Netflix. It's been there since the week before last, actually. I only got around to it and it's three parts. It is well, well worth a watch. Do let me know what you might have been watching. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. And we turn now to the week's new movie releases, which include the latest remake of a classic in the form of How to Train Your Dragon, and also an interesting movie, because I've seen this one, called Echo Valley, with the great Julianne Moore and the equally great Donald Gleeson. To make sense of all of this, delighted to be joined by film buff and freelance journalist Niamh O'Reilly, who's bared the elements of a dirty Dublin day to be here. Hello, Niamh.
Yeah, and I stupidly wore my very long jeans that have gotten all wet. But anyway, look it.
You can't put a price on style or something like that.
That's it.
So listen, How to Train Your Dragon. Now, it's not a Disney movie, but
it's in the tradition, I know, yeah, where you're going with
of remaking. Great, because I remember the first How to Train Your Dragon. I loved it all those years ago. But they've remade it. So was there any point to remaking this in a live action format?
Yeah, I mean, I get where you're coming from here. There has been a trend recently with Disney to remake a lot of their animated classics, yeah, which is so-called live action, yeah, films, and DreamWorks are jumping on the bandwagon.
I would suggest often poor results, like in the case of Snow White.
I agree with you, yeah. And The Lion King.
Yeah.
I
didn't hate that as much as everyone else did. I might have, yeah, been blinded by the fact that I was talking to man who directed Moonlight, Barry Jenkins. And he was like, it's crazy that I'm directing a Lion King movie.
Bloody. I mean, he's pretty cool. But where something like The Lion King, I think, fell down in a live action version, because you're never going to get, you know, quote unquote, live action lions to emote in the same way,
no,
as singing, dancing cartoon ones. How to Train Your Dragon doesn't have that problem as such, because we're talking about a dragon.
Yeah.
Dragons aren't real. And if
what?
Anything, yeah. If anything, Toothless, who is the dragon in this film, looks even better.
Okay. And does it follow the story of the first movie?
It does. So it is...
Or the original movie.
It is pretty much a shot-for-shot remake here.
Okay.
I mean, you could run the two films beside one another, and all of those big set pieces and special beats from the first animated film are here.
Wow.
Exactly the same way.
Does it have the same director?
It has the same two directors.
Wow.
And it also has Jerry Butler playing Stoic, who is the chief Viking. And he was a voice actor in the first
one.
And
yeah,
he's in this in live action. So it almost feels like they were getting the gang back together to remake this. And perhaps in their own minds, they wanted to put some things right that, you know, they felt weren't right in the original.
Yeah.
But the story is pretty much the same. And for people who aren't familiar, it is about a young Viking boy called Hiccup, who lives in Burk, which is sort of an island nation of Vikings, very fearsome Vikings.
Somewhere in Scandinavia.
Somewhere. It's not.
That's not war.
Yeah, it's based on a series of books by Cressida Cowell, very successful books. A lot of your children might have read them.
My many children.
Many, many children. And so he's not like the rest of the Vikings. They all live to kill dragons because they're in this terrible war with dragons. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't have it in him, and he's different, and he's an outsider. And his father is the chief, and he just his father is not disappointed in Hiccup, but he wishes that he would be more like the rest of everybody else. So when Hiccup gets a chance to kill a very fearsome dragon, who he names Toothless eventually, he doesn't do it. He just can't kill him. So instead, he befriends him and learns to fly on him. And
trains his dragon.
Trains him, essentially, and become the best of friends. And I suppose along the way shows the people of Burke that actually there's more to dragons that meet the eye.
Yeah, and it's a lovely kind of fable,
it's beautiful,
right?
Beautiful, yeah.
So, does this work?
It works on a lot of levels. I think the level it works best on is visuals, because the original was 2010, not that long ago. But if you go back and look at it, the animation looks a little dated at this point.
See, to my memory of that is it was beautiful animation, but that's probably memory playing its games.
Well, I tell you, I'm sort of a super fan of this because my children have watched all of the films. There's three films. There's two TV shows. There's also
there's
a Christmas
a TV
short.
Show. Yeah, yeah.
So I am well versed on the old How to Train Your Dragon, and the original 2010, whether they didn't have the budget or it's just animation has taken a giant leap forward, it looks a little dated.
Okay.
So Toothless in particular looks amazing in this live
CGI'd, presumably. It's not a real dragon.
Not a real dragon, but you know, he looks pretty good. But what is fantastic in this is the flying scenes. So there are a series of scenes where Hiccup is learning to fly to train Toothless, and they duck and dive and they're going up to the water and up to the clouds and in and out of caves.
Yeah.
And I saw this on IMAX and it was unreal. You felt like you were on this dragon. So from that point of view, the visuals are fantastic.
And who's the boy in this question,
in this
iteration?
So Hiccup was played by an actor called Mason Thames,
okay.
who everyone will probably remember from The Black Phone.
Oh, yes.
A really lovely actor. He's got this great quality to him. Kind of, you think he looks quite vulnerable and quite innocent, but he's got something stronger kind of behind those beautiful eyes of his. And he brings that here very well to the role of Hiccup. I would say he doesn't quite capture that gawkiness that we had from Jay Baccarat's voice work.
Is he a bit too handsome or something?
I don't know. He's got that...
Because I can have that problem too, you
he's
know?
He's got that choppy hair going on. Which you can... Like, he's only a young guy. You can see he's going to be a real heartthrob as he ages. But he does a great job with this, I have to say. I really did enjoy his portrayal. It just wasn't quite as gawky.
Yeah.
Nico Parker plays Astrid, who is one of his friends and someone who wants to slay dragons. And she's brilliant in this, I have to say. And her role is fleshed out a little bit more than it was in the original.
Yeah.
And the story of the people of Burke is fleshed out a little bit more. In the original, we didn't get much details about them. This time around, it's revealed that they're people from all over the world, Viking tribes all over the world, who've come together with a common goal to kill dragons. So that opens it up for a little bit more diversity, a little bit more depth in the cast.
And are they making some point about the wider world, you know, befriending your enemy? Or
I mean, you could drill down into that. And I heard somebody describe this as E.T. with Vikings. And I mean, they're not far off. So it is all of those themes of outsiders and, you know, judging people before you get to know them and all of that. And also your own self-worth and not having to change yourself to fit in with the crowd, you know.
Did your kids go to this with you?
They did.
Okay, so what did they make of it?
I mean, they would have given it an 11 out of 10. Like, they really loved it. But interestingly, after, you know, the joy had worn off, and I sat them down and I said, now, if we had the two films in front of us, which one would you prefer to watch? And they were a little bit stumped, and they both sort of went with the animated version. So I don't know what that says. I think they feel an emotional connection to the original. So, you know, you have to take that into account. But for some kids, this is going to be their divinity version, you know, so you can't forget either.
So, you know, the thing that gets on my nerves sometimes about these live action remakes is that it just seems like a cash grab. We had this successful product, let's redo it. But is there a smack of that, or do you think this gets by?
I think there is a smack of that. I think in all of these, I have to say, animated remakes in so-called live action, I mean, so many of them are shot for shot remakes.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a little bit of point of difference, but not enough.
Yeah.
And different doesn't always mean better.
Yes.
You know, yes, okay, the visuals, I think, are improved upon here, but that doesn't mean the original doesn't stand on its own 2 feet. And you feel like, you know, there could be a smack of cynicism here. Let's just remake it because we can.
Mm.
But I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed it. The story is still so beautiful and you can't help but get swept away. Toothless is one of the great, you know, animal characters up on screen. He's gorgeous. You can't help but fall in love with him. And the interplay between himself and Hiccup is beautiful.
Okay. So what are you going to say stars-wise for the live-action remake of How to Train Your Dragon?
I would say a very solid 3.
A solid 3. She always gives the qualifying adjectives. A solid 3 from Niamh O'Reilly. Now, this is in cinemas now. When did it...
Yes, this is now this week, yeah.
Okay, so it is there for your streaming... No, for your screening pleasure, not streaming pleasure. It's very much in the cinemas, although no doubt it will make it to a streamer eventually. Niamh O'Reilly is giving it 3 stars. Let's take a flavour. A clip there of How to Train Your Dragon, the live-action remake, which is in cinemas now. Something very different is Echo Valley, starring Julianne Moore. Niamh, I've seen this as well, releasing on Apple TV this Friday. It's not getting a cinema release, so I mean, I'm not sure if it should or not. The 13th of June. Is it?
Release. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, in sort of the Dublin area.
Okay. As well as landing on Apple TV.
Yes.
I'm not sure I get the logic of that.
No. Yeah.
It's one thing to hold it a week, but at the same day.
Yeah. As far as I know, it is.
What's going on in Echo Valley?
This is what I would call a slow burn sort of thriller, the likes of which we don't really see very often anymore.
Really more infrequent, yeah.
Yeah, it reminded me of a 90s sort of film, like it's A Hand That Rocks the Cradle kind of vibe almost to it. But anyway, we've got the brilliant Julianne Moore starring in this, and she's playing Kate, a woman who has been recently widowed. Her wife has died in tragic circumstances, and her grown-up daughter is played by Sydney Sweeney. Her name is Claire, and she is troubled, let's just say. She's had a history of substance abuse, and Kate has spent an awful lot of money, practically all of her money, getting her into rehab and, you know, pandering to her every whim, basically, just to try and help her daughter. And she's put herself into debt. She runs a horse ranch. The roof is about to cave in. Yeah. She has to go to her ex-husband in a little cameo by Kyle MacLachlan to ask for money. And he is very keen that both of them stop pandering to their daughter and effectively cut her off and let her stand on her own 2 feet. And perhaps that will help her get past this trouble that she's had in her life. It doesn't work out. No. And one evening, Claire turns up at her mother's house, very wet, very dishevelled, very distressed, a little bit of blood on her clothes, and she needs her mother's help more than ever.
Mm.
And it emerges that she's gotten into trouble with a very nasty drug dealer played by our own Donald Gleeson. Mm. And I won't say any more about what she asks her mother to help her with, but it raises questions as to how far would you go for your child.
And it becomes a thriller.
It's fair to say. It does, a lot of twists and turns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did you think of this? And that's a very good summation of it.
It's a slow burn. You know, it does take a little while to get going. And like I said, it feels like it came out in the 90s.
Mm.
There's something about it that doesn't sort of mix with today's kind of fast-paced world.
Yeah, it's not crash, bang, wallop.
No, it isn't. And I think that might turn people off. Mm. But I would encourage you to stick with it.
Yeah.
As it goes along, the twists and turns, I mean, they're quite good. I think they probably get a little bit sensational for the story. But like I said, it reminds you of kind of a Pacific Heights or a Hand That Rocks the Cradle or a Single White Female sort of vibe to it.
Julianne Moore, as always, is brilliant as this mother who just can't do enough for her troubled daughter, I thought.
Yeah, she's fantastic. I mean, that woman is great. You'd watch her read the phone book.
We were just talking about Sirens earlier in the week.
Oh, excellent.
She's just incredible.
She's everywhere.
Yeah.
She's great. She's brilliant in this. And I mean, she has a lot to do in this because there's a lot going on beneath the surface. I mean, she's grieving the loss of her wife, who she loved very much, and she's trying to get to grips with her adult daughter.
Mm.
It really does, you know, it speaks to something within you as a parent. I mean, you would do anything for your child, but where's the line?
Donald Gleeson as the baddie, as you pointed out, is sensational, isn't he? He's got blonde hair and he's doing that smiling villain thing. It's creepy.
Smiling. I don't know if you remember seeing him in that show with Steve Carell, where Steve Carell was a therapist.
Oh, The Patient.
That's The Patient.
Really creepy.
He was really, and he's got that same kind of vibe here. As you say, smiling on the outside, but oh, he can turn on a knife edge. Very nasty individual, and very, very good at playing it here. And also Fiona Shaw shows up in this
As her pal.
As Kate's neighbour.
Yeah.
And she doesn't have a lot to do, but she's very good.
She's always good. Yeah. She's always good. Yeah. And there's a quite poignant motif in it where she's listening to voicemails of her now deceased wife. Yeah. It's beautiful.
It's lovely. And at the start, you think it's a voice message, a current one.
Yeah. Maybe that's a spoiler. Oh, well.
Sorry. Well, I don't think it is. It's revealed very, very
that's
early
true.
On.
That's true.
That her wife unfortunately died very tragically, and she is alone. She's running this horse farm all by herself. She's, you know, lifting hay, trying to give lessons, and it's a tough life. And she's completely in debt because of her daughter's actions, and she desperately wants to connect with her daughter, and she thinks she might be making headway, and then, you know, this happens.
Yeah, her daughter's horrible to her at times.
Yeah, Sydney Sweeney's good in this.
She is good. She is good. So what are you going to say stars-wise for Echo Valley?
Yeah, I was torn on this, John. I was torn. I think I would say 2.5.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought you were going to say a solid 3.
No, I just feel the twists and turns at the end, I think they were a little bit unbelievable.
Okay.
I think they just made me disconnect with it a little bit and go, really? You know, because up until, I suppose, the first maybe 3/4 of the film, you're like, this is good. Mm. This is gripping. I'm very interested in where this is going and how is this going to play out. And then when it's revealed how it plays out, you're sort of like, I don't know if I buy that, really.
Okay. I'd go 3 because it held my attention and the ending didn't bother me, but you know better than I do. So Echo Valley, which is getting a limited cinema release and is also on Apple TV from this Friday the 13th of June. I was saying 3 stars, but Niamh O'Reilly gives it 2.5, a solid 2.5.
Oh, very solid. Yeah. Super solid.
And earlier she gave a very solid 3 to How to Train Your Dragon. Yes, that is back in cinemas. It is a live action version. Niamh, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Up next, Jaws at 50. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now the 21st of June will mark a huge anniversary in movies because it is the 50th anniversary of one of the greatest films ever made, Jaws, which in lots of ways invented the whole idea of a summer blockbuster. We don't have Steven Spielberg. We have perhaps the next best thing. I have never met a person who is so fond and so whose life is so defined by one particular movie. I'm talking about Ian O'Doherty, who is the biggest Jaws fan I've ever met. Ian, hello.
Hello.
And I should have described you as journalist and host of very popular podcast by the name of
The State of Us.
Yes, we'll get to that at the very end. Jaws, we could do 3 hours on this and we don't
Absolutely.
Have that time. However, I remember years ago I interviewed you about Jaws and I was like, this guy is obsessed by this movie. Why do you love Jaws so much?
Well, it's the first film I ever saw.
Really?
Yeah. I was 5.
Oof. In the cinema?
In the cinema.
Paging Tulsa.
And, well, this is the thing. I mean, if you brought a 5-year-old to see Jaws now, they would, you know, they'd have the social service telling you. But the funny thing is that I was transfixed just because it was the first time as well, being in a cinema.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the perfect storm for moulding a child's brain around a movie. But I always remember at the end, and I think it's a 50-year-old movie, so I can give away a spoiler.
Yes.
But at the end, when the shark dies and Brody shoots the diving canister and the shark blows up, I stood up in the cinema apparently and started screaming, "Murderer, murderer." And I started crying because they were in the shark's home. And they should have left him alone. And that was, I think, that was the first moment when my parents went, okay, this kid probably isn't all right, you know? But it was like, even as a 5-year-old, my sympathy was for the shark.
Wow.
And
because men were going after this creature that was in its own habitat.
I just felt really, you know, in the same way that, you know, I was about 7, I think, when I saw King Kong, the Justin Lang version, and I cried when King Kong died, you know? But I've always been on the side of the animal.
Yes.
When it comes to these things.
Tell me this, for younger listeners or people who, for some bizarre reason, haven't ever seen Jaws, it takes place in a fictional kind of place called Amity Island.
Yeah.
There's a summer season, everyone's swimming in the seas, and then this man-eating shark is going to disrupt things. And then we have Richard Dreyfuss, and you tell us.
Well, basically, they get a shark turns up in, off the waters of Amity, which is basically Martha's Vineyard, where they shot it. And the mayor insists on keeping the beach open. Brody, who's the local sheriff, has seen the first victim. And Hooper, who's a shark scientist, who's played by Richard Dreyfuss, he came in and he said, look, this is a big shark. You need to close the beaches. But the mayor refuses because it's summer money. That's how, you know, although in the book, actually, the mayor is linked in with the mafia and stuff. They drop a lot of stuff out of the book.
And in the book, just en route to you continuing what you're saying, I mean, the book is only so-so, is my understanding. I've never read it.
No, the book is really good.
Oh, okay.
But the book is really, really good, but it's very different because there's a mafia subplot. And in the book, Hooper has an affair with Brody's wife.
Okay.
And Spielberg came in and just trimmed all of that out of the way. So that's, you know, it kind of works in a book, but it wouldn't work it wouldn't work on screen. So anywho, Brody Quint, who's the sort of legendary shark hunter.
Yes.
And played by Robert Shaw. It's just an incredible performance. And the single greatest speech in movie history is the one he gives on the USS Indianapolis, which is an iconic scene. So they go out into the water to try and catch the shark and to save the people of Amity. And then that's when the movie takes a whole different turn. It goes from being sort of a kind of a summer scare fest, summer shark fest, into what I was wrong when I was on with you the last time and I said there was a Jungian subconscious thing. I was actually, because I was thinking back about it, it's just a haunted house movie.
So there's no Jungian psychology.
No, there is,
in
but it's probably more accurate to say that it's a haunted house movie, and the sea is the house, and the shark is the monster. And it's like, don't go into the basement. It's like, you know, don't go into the water.
Yeah,
and it's, this movie is perfection, right? You can love Some Like It Hot, love Orson, you know, love
The Godfather.
But I was going to say, the only two movies that come close to me to Jaws are Godfather 1 and 2, which I kind of class as one movie.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But you're looking at cinematic perfection, like alongside Citizen Kane, stuff like that. I mean, this is just an incredible film. But it had such an unbelievable impact on my life. Like even down to, I've come close to sharks twice when I've been swimming abroad, right? Well, obviously abroad, you mean, you know,
maybe. Core town.
Well, the occasional basking shark off Wexford, maybe. But I remember there was one occasion we're swimming in a lovely lagoon in a place called Xelha in Mexico off the Yucatan Peninsula. And a lifeguard came out, blew the whistle, and everybody out of the water because a reef shark had come in. So everybody got out of the water. And I swam towards the shark.
And you live to tell the tale.
And unfortunately, the shark swam away. And now, what that says about me, I don't know, you know.
Scarier than Jaws.
But I tell you, that was an interesting conversation with my wife when I got back on shore. And everybody else was on the shore and they were staring going, why is that Irish eejit swimming towards the fin?
The pale guy.
And,
tell me this, just back to the movie for a second. What I find amazing about it is, and it's not to be too pretentious about it, but the tension, the Hitchcockian tension. We see, I think it's only 4 minutes of the shark ever, but it's the cello. It's the fear of that horizon and the shark. I presume you were struck by that even as a five-year-old. You're kind of terrified, even though you're seeing nothing. Like, it's an exercise in tension building like no other movie
since.
Well,
the best thing that happened to the movie was the fact that the mechanical sharks kept on breaking down.
Yeah.
Because it would have been a completely different movie if you saw the shark in every second scene.
Yeah.
So, and the thing is, what Spielberg knew, and he was only 29 when he made it. I mean, this is incredible.
Yeah.
You know? And he thought it was going to be the last movie we were going to be allowed to make. But what Spielberg recognized, and what a lot of directors don't, is that the scariest thing is your own imagination.
Mm.
So you leave that space.
Yeah.
So what Spielberg did, and if you look at, particularly when they go out on the boat, there's a lot of these really wide-angle shots of the horizon.
Yeah.
You know, there's no sign of land. Sometimes you can see the land, but then when they're going out, you know, and they're just really literally in the middle of aquatic nowhere. And your own brain fills in that space.
Yeah.
And no director, no matter how good they are, can ever scare you as much as your own imagination. Mm. And I think that's one of the genius things about this film is that it lets you fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
And it lets you come up with the really scary stuff. And in many ways, the scenes with the shark itself are probably the least scary.
Yeah.
You know?
When you see him full-faced. Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But, like, probably the scariest scene in it for me, the one that really freaked me out, was, you recall, when the two lads go out at night with the pot roast, and because there's a bounty on the shark.
Yeah.
And so they're standing on this jetty and they're about 20 feet out into the water and they throw this pot roast out on a tire. And they're kind of laughing, saying their wife is going to kill them, you know, but if they get the bounty, it'll be great. And so the float of the tire is tied to the jetty on a chain. And then you just hear the chain unraveling and see the tire moving away. And then the jetty collapses because the shark is that strong.
Yeah.
And then your man has to get back up. And that's in the middle of the night. And that's everybody's nightmare. You're trying to scramble up something while there's a big-ass shark coming.
In the dark.
In the dark.
As an animal lover, because I was reading about this and it never really occurred to me, but it's, you know, had an efficacy in the real world in a bad way in terms of shark populations, by all accounts. I presume you're aware of this.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Spielberg and particularly Dreyfus have expressed real concern about the legacy of it and what it's done to shark populations.
Benchley, Benchley, the author, I mean, he actually, towards the end of his, I mean, he became a shark conservationist.
Mm.
As he said, to atone for my sins.
Yeah.
And he actually admits that he regrets writing it. Because when Jaws came out, all of a sudden, shark fishing became the biggest sport, water sport.
I shouldn't laugh.
In America. And no, you shouldn't actually.
No.
Because we've driven great whites to the verge of extinction.
Yeah, so I gather.
And the thing about it is, if they go, the aqua system goes.
Mm.
Well, they're vital. You know, sharks are incredible creatures. And I mean, even like, I saw one amazing documentary set off Maui, where I used to go to Maui every year, backpack maybe all that money, you know. But there's one tiger shark is quite famous because he swims up to people. Because there was a diver, he had a really, really bad fishing hook stuck in his jaw. And he was in agony and he probably would have died. And a diver actually went down and removed the hook, right? So this tiger shark, you know, terrifying shark, loves people.
Yeah.
And goes up to people. I mean, they're a fascinating creature. Mm. And we always had, like in the movie, they say they sleep, they eat, they make little sharks. That is not the case at all. They're very complex social systems. Sharks are known that they will actually have a best friend for life.
And also, you know, I read a statistic in 1975, you had more chance of being bitten by someone in New York than by a shark. I mean, they were never really going to go after humans.
That's probably increased now in the last few years.
That may have changed somewhat. Tell me this, and as I say, that movie is clearly, clearly deep with you.
I love it so much. It was on twice on successive days over the Christmas, and so I watched Jaws twice.
No harm in that. Tell me this, and maybe it's heresy to even bring them up, the sequels, which I can't even remember, are they terrible?
Jaws 2 is okay.
Okay.
And funny enough, I'll tell it very quickly. It was the first time I ever heard Ireland being mentioned in an American movie was that the kids are on this boat and they're kind of drifting and they're going past the lighthouse and they go past the lighthouse, they're in trouble. They go past the lighthouse. One of the kids turned around and he goes, oh God, next stop Ireland. And as a 9-year-old, you're going, oh my God, the Americans know who we are. But Jaws 2 was good. After that, I mean, to say the law of diminishing returns would be an understatement.
Absolutely. That is Jaws. That is Ian O'Doherty, a man who swam towards the shark in 30 seconds. Your new podcast, The State of Us, is already number one. Now, a lot of people make those bold claims, but as things stand today, it is number one.
No,
in the podcast.
The first episode went to number one.
Okay.
And I have the pictures as proof.
Yeah.
That was an interview with Graeme Linehan, where if anybody wants to check it out, it's The State of Us. It's on Apple, Spotify, YouTube. Where Graham actually goes into the details of the Father Ted musical, which was cancelled. My fourth one went out yesterday with the English journalist Michael Murphy. That's had 10,000 views so far on YouTube. It's doing really well. And you know what's great? it's annoying all the right people.
Well, it's not annoying me. So if after listening to this show, you're looking for something else to listen to, why not check out The State of Us, which is on all podcast platforms. In the meantime, Eoin Doherty has been talking about his, well, quite simply, his love of not just sharks, but the movie Jaws on the occasion of its 50th anniversary. Eoin, thanks a million.
Thank you for having me on.
This is a great white, Larry. A big one. And any shark expert in the world will tell you it's a killer. It's a man-eater.
Look, the situation is that apparently a great white shark has staked a claim in the waters off Amity Island. And he is going to continue to feed here as long as there is food in the water.
And there's no limit to what he's going to do. I mean, we've already had 3 incidents. 2 people killed inside of a week, and it's going to happen again. It happened before. The Jersey Beach.
1916, there were 5
people chewed up in the surf.
In 1 week.
Tell them about the swimmers.
A shark is attracted to the exact kind of splashing and activity that occurs whenever human beings go in swimming. You cannot avoid it.
If you open the beaches on the 4th of July, it's like ringing the dinner bell, for Christ's
sake.
Look,
Mr. Vaughn, I pulled a tooth the size of a shot glass out of the wreck hull of a boat out there, and it was the tooth of a great white.
A clip there from Jaws, which turns 50 next week. And that is quite simply a game-changing movie. It invented the summer blockbuster. And my thanks to Eoin Doherty, who loves his movies. Up next, Dino Don. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time. Something a little different. We were talking earlier in the show about one of Steven Spielberg's great creature movies, and that was, of course, Jaws. But we now turn to Jurassic Park, because for an amazing event in Dublin Zoo at the end of the month, they're going to be joined by Don Lessem, who is known as Dino Don, considered one of the great, I suppose, dinosaur experts of the world. He was the special advisor to Spielberg on Jurassic Park, the first film, and has dedicated his life to dinosaurs and even has one named after him, which is pretty incredible. He's written books. He's done all sorts of dinosaur-related stuff. And he's even advised on Disney parks in terms of their dinosaur rides and stuff like that. He is the man behind Jurassic Trail, currently in Dublin Zoo. As I say, he's coming to Dublin Zoo at the end of the month, and you can get tickets to a special event where he's going to be talking all things dinosaurs, all things Jurassic Park. And I'm delighted to say, by the wonders of intertechnology or something like that, he joins me live from the States. Don, how are you?
I'm fine, John.
So tell me this. I know you're probably so tired answering this question, but movie lovers love to know, because Jurassic Park, I remember seeing it in a cinema and seeing that famous scene when we first see the dinosaur in the rain. Just how evocative it was, how kind of scary it was. Did you have in mind that was going to look that way for that scene with Spielberg, or was it all his doing? How much credit for that can you take?
Well, I'll give you a clue. When you watch the credits of the movie, if you stay with it at the end, the first name is Spielberg, then there's almost everyone in North America, and then my name is the last one. That will give you an image. Actually, the first glimpse I had, no one's ever asked me that, John, was not of that, but of walking into the set room before getting out to the where they film inside a big Quonset hut on Universal set. Mm-hmm. And there were 6 Raptor suits my size hanging up on a rack. And I thought, wait, I thought this was a movie of, you know, special effects. Mm. We were going to be using robots. And they said, no, when you do a close-up scene like we're going to do in the kitchen, if you remember, the dinosaurs jump up on the table and scare the kids. You can't do that with a robot, and you can't do it with CGI. So we hired the guys who play Ninja Turtles, and we got these suits for them to put on so they can jump on the table.
Wow.
They don't advertise that because it's not so special, a special effect.
Yeah. And did Spielberg, like, how did your association with Jurassic Park begin? Did they just call you up or?
Not quite. I was friendly with Michael Crichton, the guy who wrote the book. And I had started a charity for dinosaur research because in my reporting, which was my actual job, I would go all over the world to dinosaur digs, and those guys had no money. They were discovering new dinosaurs on $10,000 or less. And I felt it was sort of unjust, given all the money that's made, including by movies, on this. And nicely, Crichton agreed and said, I'll introduce you to this short guy with a lot of money, Spielberg.
And did you have to, I mean, you know, these things can be, well, back in the day, there probably wasn't even emails. Well, emails were starting, but were you hands-on? Were you on set a lot?
Yeah, we did cave drawings then, John. So it sent me a rune. I went out to the set many times. Unfortunately, I missed Hawaii, which is where the lovely outdoor scenes were shot.
Yeah.
But I was out in the desert, which turned out to be a really bizarre experience, as well as on the set in California. The desert was bizarre because they were simulating a dinosaur dig, the thing that I do all the time. Mm-hmm. But it was in a state park where they're not allowed to dig. So they had to make a fake hole with a kind of wall above it so that the level of the ground became recessed. And then they had all these guys dressed up in business shirts digging. So when I arrived, I said, this is ridiculous. Everybody on a dig smells terrible. They haven't had a bath in a week. You can't really have them in iron shirts. And they said, well, what are we supposed to do? I said, well, you need like really dirty t-shirts. And they said, where are we going to get them? I said, I have a whole suitcase full. So that was my biggest contribution to the film were my dirty t-shirts.
come. But I mean, in terms of how well the dinosaurs looked, and I mentioned that particular scene in it, but them all, I do remember being in the cinema and going, by God, and this was kind of before CGI had become omnipresent, just how great the dinosaurs looked. I mean, you did have a big part in that, right?
Yes. I don't want to overplay it because they spent almost 2 years preparing the animals. And then the filming was done in less than a month. The deal that Spielberg had with Universal was he got a third of the gross of the movie, which turned out to be over $300 million. But it would cost him $1 million for every day he ran over. And a month is very quick to shoot a movie. He finished it all in 29 days because he spent so much time choreographing all of it beforehand. So right. All the dinosaurs were really prepared. And of course, it takes great variance with the facts. And that was the hard part for me, was sitting there while I'm looking at dinosaurs that, you know, they're very convincing, but they're inaccurate.
Okay.
Many, many times. And trying to keep my mouth shut was really hard for me, as you can tell.
And was there any moment at it you said, look, Steve, it looks great, but I'm sorry, a T-Rex did not have, and pardon my ignorance here, 7 toes or whatever. Like, did you interrupt at any stage and say, no?
Of course. When they were filming, actually, the first scene that I saw, which was out in the desert, I don't know if you remember, but Laura Dern, the female actress, was looking at a screen that a guy had set up whereby he could look into the ground and see the dinosaur skeleton. And of course, nothing like that exists. But he was saying, oh, it took millions of years for it to get to this kind of curved, arched position for the skeleton. And I thought, no, this happens with rigor mortis in about an hour after you die. So I told the third assistant director I was hanging out with, and they said, well, go tell Steven. And we went up and rewrote the line. So that was sort of my intro to this. But there was a limit because, all these animals had been designed. And so if I said, for instance, the Dilophosaurus, the little spitter, didn't really spit. It was 20 feet long, and it didn't have a frill. And other than that, it's perfect. And they said, well, you know, maybe just go eat the shrimp and try and be quiet.
Tell me this. You've been doing this most of your adult life, and dinosaurs have been, you know, your working life. And I don't mean to be facetious. I mean this genuinely. But
yes.
Why do you want to dedicate your life to dinosaurs? I mean, for devil's advocacy, one could say they're not around anymore. Like, is this not a fool's errand to be looking to the past?
It's a horrible question. The worst, because it betrays your adulthood. Dinosaurs are one of the most important things in childhood. And they represent a sense of wonder and awe. And the fact that we can't feel it, unless sometimes we look at a giant movie screen, we're missing out on the coolest things that ever lived. Animals the size of buildings that could walk around. And these live in the imagination of children, especially between the ages of 3 to 8. And it inspires their love of nature and the world. They're much more interested when they go to the zoo at that age in the dinosaurs than they are in the living animals in front of them. So there's this hugely important transitional thing between total fantasy and present day real life.
Yeah.
I think that's amazing. And the study of them too, is just like this wonderful jigsaw puzzle that you don't have all the pieces, or you go on a scavenger hunt and you know, you don't know what you're going to find. It's not brain surgery. You find something and you can try to piece it together. But the idea that you could be the first person to see an animal that nobody's ever seen. I mean, that's pretty awe-inspiring.
Absolutely. That's such a beautiful way of putting it. And I can't state enough how I'm playing devil's advocate, because I have three children, and in particular, the youngest one, who's now six, is dinosaur obsessed. Yeah. I can't convey to you how many dinosaur teddies and things we have in our house. And it's fascinating for me to hear you saying that in a way it's a bridge between fantasy and reality. I have a newfound appreciation of the benefit of dinosaurs. Tell me this. In Dublin Zoo, I have been, and I go many times, and I've talked on this show about it, because it's a wonderful institution, and I went there as a kid and it wasn't as nice back then. They've done a wonderful job. But I've seen the dinosaurs that have been there a few months. Are you responsible for how animatronically good they look?
Yes. The story behind it is that these are all built by my company. I never liked robots. I always thought they were a rather inaccurate presentation. They always had sort of St. Vitus dance and they were kind of half-sized. And I went to see a dinosaur quarry in China about 7 years ago that is the best quarry of fossil discoveries in the world. When I was there, the guide said, why don't you go see the factories? Because all the robots in the world pretty much are made here. I said, I don't want to. They suck. He said, well, just go. And I went and I saw that there's no mold. In other words, they were making the same dumb mistakes over and over again because nobody ever told them the right way to make them. So I realized that if I, you know, sent scientists and artists, which I did, we could make full-size and accurate animals up to 100 feet long. So we've made now about 400 dinosaurs. I came to Dublin actually once before to the zoo, saw how beautiful it is there. It really is one of the world's great zoos. And it would be wonderful to have dinosaurs in that very forested environment. And it took a few years to convince them, and very nicely they agreed.
They look terrific. I was there maybe about 6 weeks ago. Tell me this. How did you get a dinosaur named after you? I mean, for someone who does what you do, this must be like, I don't know, me getting to interview Robert De Niro, which I did 6 weeks ago, said he name-droppingly. But I mean, this must be the zenith of you. Or maybe not. Maybe it's just like, I don't know. But you tell me, how did it happen and how much did it mean to you?
Oh, it's wonderful because it means if I don't get invalidated, I will live forever. half of all the dinosaurs named turn out to be named wrong. I mean, people have mistaken driftwood for dinosaurs or pieces of owls.
Okay.
So I was very worried when a paper showed up on my doorstep. You can't ask to have a dinosaur named after you.
No.
And you can't do it for yourself. That's
maybe if you're Nick Cage, you can, but let's not get into that now.
It's very gauche. So it showed up on my doorstep. A paper is actually in Spanish, but it had a little English précis at the top. And it said, this dinosaur, Lesimosaurus, named after this guy, me, who had I'd raised a lot of money for dinosaur research. Actually a touring exhibit about what was wrong with Jurassic Park using the robots. So I read about this dinosaur in the paper, and it was a large-bellied dinosaur. And I worried that maybe this was a fragmentary find and it wouldn't hold up. But over the years, they found many more skeletons, and it turns out that this is actually a fairly important transitional animal between the primitive big dinosaurs and the giant guys like what we call Brontosaurus. So, it's very cool to me to have a dinosaur. During the movie, just if you got a second, at the end of a movie, they always have a wrap party, WRAP, where they give cars and other things to actors who don't need them. And Spielberg didn't like that idea very much. And I had told him he could have a dinosaur named for him, and which I could arrange for a certain amount of money from a Chinese or other scientist who was doing a new discovery. He was not an egotistical guy. He didn't care, but he said, well, can you name it after the cast and we'll give them a plaque instead of cars? So there was a new armored dinosaur, and we had it named Jurassosaurus, and then the species name, like T-Rex, being a species. We made this mouthful, Netagoa perfricomorum, which is Sam Neill, N-E, Laura Dern, D-E, Jeff Goldblum, G-O, Attenborough, A, on and on and on for the whole rest of the cast. So all these guys expecting a Mercedes got a bronze plaque, and they probably never will talk to me if I ever see them again.
And just to be clear, your one is called Lesimosaurus. What's the name of your dinosaur?
Bob, to his friends. Lesimosaurus.
Lessonsaurus. Excellent. Well, listen, we've only scratched the surface, but if you do want to hear more from Don Lessum, he's going to be at Dublin Zoo as part of their Jurassic Trail. He's going to be talking in Dublin Zoo as part of this event from Thursday the 26th and also on Friday the 27th of June from 6 to 8:30. You can get a selfie with him, I'm told. He's going to be looking at some fossils. He's going to be answering your questions. He's going to be interviewed. You can find out more, dublinzoo.ie. Don, we only scratched the surface, but it was the most fascinating chat. Lovely to chat to you.
Oh, my pleasure. And if you don't bring your children out to those events, I am going to report people to the social services. So I do hope they'll come.
Well said. Don Lessum there, the very entertaining Don Lessum, who was Spielberg's Jurassic Park advisor, and he is leading the Jurassic Trail takeover at Dublin Zoo this June. Go to dublinzoo.ie for more details. And in particular, there is an event on Thursday and Friday, the 26th and the 27th of June at 6:30 in Dublin Zoo, where you can hear Don in conversation and hear all about his fascinating career and even get some photos and look at some fossils with him. So dublinzoo.ie for two very entertaining evenings ahead. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, All Going to Plan, I'm talking to Danny Boyle about 28 years later and a bit more besides. Lots of good stuff to come in the weeks ahead as we enter the summer. But listen, don't worry about that now. Sit back, enjoy the remainder of your weekend. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. You can listen to this show or any of the previous shows from the last 6 years on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you all next week.